Here's where you can find out more about what goes on in what are categorized as mild and complicated mild traumatic brain injury. Welcome to our Brain Science and the Law podcast for May 2010 on what happens in cases of what are categorized as mild traumatic brain injury. This is Valerie Stone from Answers About Brain Injury, LLC. In today's podcast, I want to cover five key points. First, what differentiates mild traumatic brain injury from complicated mild traumatic brain injury is whether any abnormalities are found in brain imaging or in a neurological exam of the person injured. So there's a problem with this definition. What happens if no imaging was taken? Or what if the imaging that was taken was not sensitive enough to show damage that really is there? Second point, different types of imaging are not equally sensitive. I'll talk in detail about what kinds of imaging show what. Third point, in your law practice, you are not going to see a representative cross-section of cases of traumatic brain injury. You're going to see the more severe cases. So you will see very few people with a true mild traumatic brain injury. Fourth point, who will you see in your practice? You'll see, obviously, moderate to severe TBI, and you may also see some of those 15% of people who have a lasting effect from what was categorized as a mild TBI. What's going on with this group? While some of them, in fact, have a complicated mild TBI, you may also see some who have no abnormalities on any kind of imaging, but who have a lasting effect from a mild TBI. Fifth point, do not assume that just because someone was categorized as a mild TBI by a doctor that they necessarily fall in that category. Look for corroborating evidence, and we'll talk about what kind of evidence to look for. Point number one that I want to go over is about the problematic definition of mild TBI. If you've worked with brain injury cases before, you'll know that there are four levels of severity that emergency room doctors use to categorize traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs. Four things go into this definition. First is, what is the person's score on something called the Glasgow Coma Scale? If it's a high score, 13 to 15, meaning the person is alert and aware 30 minutes after the injury, then it would be categorized as a mild TBI, or a complicated mild TBI. If the score on the Glasgow Coma Scale is between a 9 and 12, indicating some confusion and lack of orientation to surroundings, lack of response, then it would be categorized as a moderate TBI. In a severe TBI, the score on the Glasgow Coma Scale would be 8 or lower. That would indicate lack of awareness and response to the surrounding circumstances. The second thing that's used to define the severity of TBI is the duration of the person's loss of consciousness. If it's less than 30 minutes, then it's a mild TBI or a complicated mild TBI. If it's 30 minutes to 24 hours, it's a moderate TBI. If it's more than 24 hours, it's a severe TBI. One problem with that definition is that sometimes there's not an observer who really is keeping close track of whether the person lost consciousness or for how long. It depends on who's at the scene of the accident and how they're observing what's going on. The third criterion that's used is the duration of post-traumatic amnesia. For what period of time did the person not have memory of what was going on? If that's less than 24 hours, it's a mild TBI or a complicated mild TBI. Between 24 hours and 1 week, it's a moderate TBI. More than a week of post-traumatic amnesia, and it's a severe TBI. Finally, the fourth criterion, and this is really what differentiates mild and complicated mild TBI, is what was found when any brain imaging was done. Now, the reason they do brain imaging, and it's usually a CT scan in the emergency room, is to find out whether there's any swelling in the brain, the jargon word for that is cerebral edema, or whether there's some kind of bleed in the brain, what's called a subdural hematoma. Either of those can be fatal. So it's very important for emergency room docs to find out whether or not that's happening, so they know whether they need to do an emergency surgery intervention or not. If they do a CT scan and they see that there's some structural damage there on the scan, then the person will be classified as a complicated mild TBI. Oftentimes, if they don't see anything on the CT scan, the person will be categorized as a mild TBI. Now, here's the real problem with that. CT scans are a very useful tool in the emergency room for checking for swelling of the brain or whether there's a bleed in the brain, but they're not very sensitive. They can't show all the kinds of structural damage to the brain that can occur after a traumatic brain injury. It's even possible that in a moderate or severe TBI, you may or may not see damage. CT scans are not sensitive to the kinds of more lasting brain damage that can happen after traumatic brain injury. So the bottom line here is that you shouldn't take the fact that an emergency room doctor categorized something as a mild TBI to mean that the person doesn't necessarily have a complicated mild TBI. There may be some kind of structural abnormality present in the brain that simply wasn't picked up on the CT scan that they did. Second problem is that sometimes they don't do any brain scan. If there's no report of the person having a loss of consciousness, they may think it's not that serious, and they may not even perform a CT scan in the emergency room. They might just say, oh, it's a concussion, mild TBI, you'll be fine. They may simply categorize it as a mild TBI without actually doing any imaging or a neurological exam to see whether it is in fact mild. If no imaging was done and there are positive findings on a neurological exam, then it may be also categorized as a complicated mild TBI. This brings us to our second point, which is we've said that CT scans are not sensitive. There are a variety of kinds of brain imaging that can be taken, and all those different types of imaging are not equally sensitive to the kind of damage that you would see after traumatic brain injury. So let me go real quickly through what your options are. For a static picture and structural scan, you pretty much got a CT scan, an MRI scan, or what's called diffusion tensor imaging. A CT scan is a computed tomography scan. It's like a sophisticated X-ray that can show a cross-section of the brain and show you some of what's going on with brain tissue. But it's not very spatially sensitive. It doesn't have very good resolution. So it's like looking at a grainy picture instead of a detailed picture. So CT scans simply aren't very sensitive, period, to showing damage in the brain. Someone could have a stroke and a small area of damage after a stroke, and that might not show up on a CT scan either, whereas it would show up on an MRI. So if you're looking for an actual, what neurologists call a lesion, an area of damaged tissue, and that's a small area, an MRI scan is going to be more sensitive than a CT scan. An MRI scan stands for magnetic resonance imaging, and I'm not going to bore you by going into the physics of how that works. Let's just say that it's something that's a lot more spatially sensitive than a CT scan and really shows very fine-grained areas of damage in what's called gray matter in the brain, which is the cell bodies of your nerve cells in the brain. So if there's damage in gray matter, either a CT scan or an MRI scan is going to show what's going on, depending on the size of the area of damage. However, neurons, the nerve cells in your brain, have both a cell body and then a long connective fiber called an axon. The axons are also called white matter. Unfortunately, what happens in traumatic brain injury is often that the white matter is damaged. And here's a limitation of both CT and MRI scans. They don't show white matter. They simply don't show it very well. So you could have massive damage to white matter in the brain, and it wouldn't show up on either a CT scan or an MRI scan. So to do a CT scan or an MRI scan, to not see anything after brain injury and say, oh, well, then there's nothing wrong with the brain, is simply a false statement that's not backed up by science. Now, what will show damage to white matter in the brain is a new technique called diffusion tensor imaging. It does begin with a series of MRI scans, but there's a particular way of processing those scans to get information about what's happening to different kinds of tissue in the brain. And it's much better than other kinds of scans for showing what's going on with white matter. There's abundant research now to show that diffusion tensor imaging is sensitive to structural damage following traumatic brain injury. There's even some new evidence that I saw in a conference back in October. It's just being published now. It's probably in press, but not in print yet, showing that even in mild traumatic brain injury, in some cases, you can show lasting structural damage using diffusion tensor imaging. Now, sad to say, this may not be very useful in your practice because getting diffusion tensor imaging on a client is not cheap or easy to do. And the reason for that is really that it's expensive not so much because of the imaging technology itself, but because of the quantitative processing, the analysis of the MRI scan data that has to take place to give you a diffusion tensor image. So there's a lot of staff time, there's a lot of computational time. I don't know of any insurance companies that will yet pay for that. However, that doesn't mean you couldn't convince them that that's true, using the right kind of science, that they should be paying for the kind of imaging that's going to show what's going on with their patient. Furthermore, in the courtroom, you can easily undermine another side's claim that, well, there's nothing on the CT or the MRI, so there's nothing wrong with this person's brain, by bringing up the latest science about diffusion tensor imaging. Those three types of imaging will give you static pictures of the brain. But it's also very important to know about brain function after traumatic brain injury and whether the brain is functioning normally or not. And so for that, you may need some kind of active, dynamic picture of the brain, or what we call functional imaging. Two kinds of dynamic imaging show brain function by showing electrical activity in the brain. And three kinds of dynamic imaging show brain function by showing which neurons are most active based on where blood is flowing most in the brain. The idea being that neurons that are more active require more blood, require more energy, and so you look at where blood is flowing the most in the brain to get an idea of what regions are most active. One type that you're probably familiar with is EEG, electroencephalography. By placing electrodes on the scalp of the person and picking up electrical activity in the surface of the brain underneath, that shows patterns of activity. Limitations of EEG are that it's not very spatially precise. It's not going to show you a very small area of abnormality in brain activity. You can also do a PET scan or a SPECT scan, which use images at about the same spatial resolution as a CT scan, but they're dynamic images. Now, there are some problems with those, too. Again, the spatial resolution is as limited as with a CT scan. Again, if there's a small area of abnormality, you're not going to see it on those. There's functional magnetic resonance imaging, which has made huge advances in the last 15 years and would give you pretty good spatial resolution on seeing areas of abnormality. However, it is going to depend on the skill of whoever does the functional MRI scan. So what are the areas of the brain where you're most likely to see abnormalities after a traumatic brain injury? We know that structural abnormalities are most likely in the underneath surface of the frontal lobes, the part of the frontal lobes that sits over the eyes, and in the frontmost part of the temporal lobes. The temporal lobes are along the side of the brain, so they're kind of under your temples, under your ears. Both of those areas, it's a little tricky to get a good image of them on functional MRI, and I'm not going to go into the technical details of why, but it takes a skilled technician to be able to get a good functional image of what's going on in those brain regions. So you need to really talk to whoever's doing the imaging and make sure they know how to do that. Now, the most sensitive kind of functional imaging that you can get of the brain is magnetoencephalography, or MEG. This is quite new. Again, I'm not going to go into the quantum physics of explaining exactly how that works, but it's much more spatially sensitive and much more time sensitive at looking at electrical activity in the brain. It basically means the person sits in some extraordinarily expensive equipment with a kind of a helmet over the head with magnetic detectors that pick up electrical activity in the brain. There is some recent research just published in the end of 2009 showing that MEG is sensitive to long-term functional abnormalities in mild TBI, even in cases where it doesn't show up on other kinds of imaging. So I think it's going to be part of the way of the future, but we're not there yet. I think that 10 years down the road, the picture will be very different. Nevertheless, if you're aware that this happens and you can bring this science into the courtroom, you can argue that other kinds of functional imaging may not be sensitive enough to show what's going on with the client. I want to point out another limitation of all of these kinds of functional imaging, simply one that you need to be aware of and make sure that if you're going to present evidence based on functional imaging, you can present strong evidence rather than a vulnerable case. You need to show not only that it's sensitive to damage and changes after traumatic brain injury, you also need to show that the kinds of patterns that you see on that kind of imaging are specific to traumatic brain injury. So, for instance, this is a problem with SPECT imaging. SPECT imaging shows cerebral blood flow, so it shows activity in the brain by showing blood flow to neurons that need it the most because they're the most active. Unfortunately, although there are changes after traumatic brain injury that you can pick up on SPECT, and there are some people in the Denver area who will do SPECT imaging for that reason, there is very little scientific evidence to show that those changes following traumatic brain injury are necessarily specific. So the same pattern that you see after traumatic brain injury in a SPECT imaging scan, you might see that same pattern in someone who's bipolar or who has some other abnormality that may not be able to be attributed to the brain injury itself. And so if you have a plaintiff with a traumatic brain injury and you bring forward a case using SPECT as your imaging, you're vulnerable then to a defense attorney who may say, yes, but how do we know that that particular kind of abnormality was caused by the brain injury itself? So you need to be very careful in doing this. It's the same thing with EEG or functional MRI. Functional MRI, we have a pretty good picture of the kinds of abnormalities that can be caused. It can be a bit more specific. But again, you're going to need to know the science to back that up. EEG, same thing. There are particular patterns that do seem to be specific to TBI. You're going to need to know that the specialist who's presenting your EEG evidence can show that those patterns of abnormality are specific to TBI rather than other kinds of mental patterns that might cause abnormalities on the EEG. On to our third point. In your law practice, if you're a plaintiff's attorney, you are not going to see a representative cross-section of cases of traumatic brain injury. You're going to see the more severe cases, the people who have lasting problems as a result. I don't believe that you're going to see very many people who truly have a mild TBI. Most people who have experienced a mild traumatic brain injury never go to a doctor or a hospital. They have a concussion, they move on. 85% of people categorized as mild TBI, these figures include both people who do and do not go to doctors or emergency rooms, 85% of those people recover completely within anywhere from a few days to 3 months. So these 85% very rarely end up in lawyers' offices because they recover, they're fine. So you're not going to see these people. So this brings us to our fourth point. Who will you see in your law practice? Obviously, you'll see cases of moderate to severe TBI. You're also going to see some of those 15% of people who have a lasting effect from what was categorized back in the emergency room as a mild TBI. So what's going on with this 15%, with this group of people? Well, some of them, in fact, are going to have a complicated mild TBI. They're going to have some kind of long-lasting brain damage that wasn't picked up on any imaging that was done, or maybe no imaging was done. So they've been categorized as a mild TBI, but they're not really a mild TBI. They're a complicated mild TBI. You also may see some who truly have what would be categorized as a mild TBI, and no abnormalities are going to show up on any kind of imaging, but people who do have a lasting effect from that mild TBI. Some people do, and those effects tend to turn up in a very specific way in their ability to sustain attention on tasks for a long time. It takes the most subtle cognitive testing to pick up on that. That in itself is a whole separate topic, what those attentional deficits look like. You may also get one or two people in your office who are going to be trying to scam benefits when they don't need them. I think that's going to be pretty obvious. If you look at someone's life, at what those close to them say, and you look at their psychological tests, you can tell whether or not someone has been changed by a mild TBI. And obviously, you're not going to want to take those cases that are going to be difficult to win because there's no evidence of lasting problems. I think those are actually very few, and you're not going to see very many of those in your office. So when you do get someone in your office who says that they have a mild TBI or whose medical reports say that they have a mild TBI, that brings us to our fifth point. Do not assume that just because someone was categorized as having a mild TBI by a doctor that they necessarily fall into that category. Look for evidence that it's actually a complicated mild TBI. So what kind of evidence should you look for? First of all, you're going to want to make sure that a neurological exam was done. Second, you're going to want to make sure that some kind of brain imaging was done. You want to make sure it's the most sensitive you can possibly get. Third, you're going to want to make sure that you have the best neuropsychological testing and the most sensitive neuropsychological testing that's sensitive particularly to the kinds of deficits that people who have traumatic brain injuries have. Now, not all psychological testing is created equal. IQ tests, for example, very often someone can have a very severe TBI, but their IQ can be perfectly intact. Don't necessarily rely on a Halstead-Reitan or a partial Halstead-Reitan as evidence that the person is fine. There are all kinds of neuropsychological tests that a person with a brain injury, even a severe brain injury, might be able to do fine on. They'll be completely wiped out and fatigued afterwards, but getting a good score on the test cannot necessarily be used as evidence that the person doesn't have lasting deficits. For mild traumatic brain injury, you might want to look at something like the PACED Auditory Serial Addition Test, which is an incredibly difficult test, but that's why it's so sensitive. The pattern of deficits that you see on the PACED Auditory Serial Addition Test, or the PASAT, is specific to mild TBI. It's different from the pattern of deficits you would see if someone was depressed or bipolar or using substances, so there is a specific pattern of deficits for mild TBI on that test. There are other sensitive neuropsychological tests also. that can pick up what's going on in people who have what's been categorized as a mild TBI. So you want to make sure you have a very good clinical neuropsychologist, preferably board certified in neuropsychology, who can do the best testing to pick up the deficits that that person has. And finally, to have a strong case to present that the defense attorneys are not going to be able to attack on questions of quote-unquote malingering, you'll want to do some kind of symptom validity test and make sure that the person's putting forth full effort on that test. Or you're going to want to have a very sophisticated scientific argument against medical symptom validity testing, which is going to be tough if you don't know the science. But there are medical symptom validity tests that psychologists give that even people with severe intellectual disabilities, people with Alzheimer's, can do just fine on. So your client should be able to do fine on it also. So those are key kinds of evidence that you would want. Neurological exam, sensitive imaging, appropriate sensitive psychological testing, and some kind of symptom validity test. Those would make a strong case. Thanks for listening to this month's Brain Science and the Law podcast. I've talked about some research about brain imaging, about different kinds of psychological testing in this podcast. If you're interested in that, call me or email me. That information is on my website. Information in this podcast is up to date as of May 2010. As you know, the science of traumatic brain injury is constantly evolving. For more information about brain injury and for information about CLE workshops that we offer about brain injury, go to our website, www.assesscompetency.com. This summer, we'll have a podcast interview with Tom Mateer, a leading attorney winning brain injury cases in Colorado and the West, with some great advice on personal injury cases that involve brain injury. I'll also have a podcast about how to objectively demonstrate the kinds of social and emotional problems that occur as a result of traumatic brain injury. These social and emotional problems are neurological problems, not just a reaction to the injury. Thanks, and have a great month.